Then he reaches into his pocket and pulls out a comb. It was so much better before. I'm in the same flat. Then it cost me 450 marks a month, and now it's 804. So what if we didn't have bananas and mandarins? It doesn't take a banana to turn me on. He runs the comb carefully through his coiffure. I used to be able to get 5 kilos of potatoes for next to nothing. Beer was 50 pfennig a can, and now what? Transport was 30 pfennig, and 20 on Fridays. I mean, we had a social state. You didn't even have to pay for the medicine. I tell you, I just don't get it. It's all stupid now. I glimpse past him and see that his friends are nodding in silent, unsteady agreement. I've heard this kind of thing before, though ex-Stasi men, privileged left-wing intellectuals or former party members, complain more about airfares. What good is freedom to travel when I can't afford to go to New York, Las Palmas, New Zealand for my holiday? Once in Leipzig, an old woman in a pub, drinking her daily schnapps at 4 in the afternoon, said to me, "Well, this is better than the Weimar Republic and better than the Nazis, but bring back the communists is what I say. The pubs were fuller under Honecker. Cheers!" I don't doubt this genuine nostalgia, but I think it has coloured a cheap and nasty world golden. A world where there was nothing to buy, nowhere to go, and anyone who wanted to do anything with their lives other than serve the party risked persecution or worse. The morning has come alive now. Insects dance over the grass and pollen hangs in the light as people walk through the park to Rosenthaler Platz station. Professor Mushroom is on a roll. "Back then, when you were drunk, the police would just take you under the arms and set you down on a bench. Now we can't even sleep here anymore, or we get robbed. It's terrible, the morals these days. Do you know you can get mugged for 1 cigarette? It's the Russian mafia and the Romanians and the gypsies. If a gypsy woman came and danced on this bench, I tell you, your wallet would be gone in a flash." This complaint, too, I have heard before in different versions. An ache for a lost time when things were more secure. In a security state, after all, the least the authorities could do when they were incarcerating so many innocents was to clean up the criminals at the same time. "Look, 200 meters over there." Professor Mushroom extends his arm, and I see a swathe of grey chest hair between his braces. "Was the wall. Before we had that, the Vessis flocked over here and bought up all our stuff. We put up the wall so we could go shopping in our own shops. In the end, though, they pulled the wall down and bought us all up anyway, those Vessis with their Western money, all the factories and businesses and even the pubs. And they won't let us hold our heads high now, oh no. I'll tell you honestly about the border." He pats my knee again. "And I am an honest man. We all knew, every GDR citizen knew, that if you went close to it, you'd be shot. That's all there was to it. So we stayed here. I mean, they should have all sat here on their arses. Then they wouldn't have got them shot full of lead." I know this argument as well. If you didn't buck the system, then it wouldn't harm you. But from what I have seen, it probably would. The professor shakes my hand. "You really should come mushrooming with us," he says. The chorus rumbles and nods, and I thank them and go, up to my palace of light and air and lino. Chapter 26. The Wall. In this soft spring I have taken to walking everywhere. It's about 10 p.m. and the sun has only just set. Cherry trees lining the streets scatter pips and juice stains over the pavement like blood. I walk home past the outdoor cafes at the Kollwitzplatz, where students, largely from the West, sit eating and laughing. I'm not sure how much they know of what has gone on in this place. I'm dreaming at the curb as a woman in a jester's cap and short shorts nearly clips my ear as she cycles past. By the time I turn into my street, the sky is black. A man is hunched unsteadily against my building, banging along it like a fly at a window. In the darkness, he is more a shape than a person, an outline with a bottle in his hand. He is drunk, very drunk. When I get closer, he reaches towards me and speaks, but it's not clear whether he's addressing me or the universe.
"I don't want to be German anymore,"
he sobs.
"I don't want to be German anymore."
His face is tracked with silver tears. "Why not?" I hold out a hand to steady him.
"We are terrible."
He has already looked at me. He couldn't know I'm not German.
"They are terrible. The Germans are terrible."
He moves off, tapping his way along the buildings. Which Germans did he mean, some or all? For this East German man, long used to thinking the bad Germans were on the other side of the wall, maybe now it's hard to tell. Are they really so bad? Or are they worse than he thought? And were his people, now broke or drunk, shamed or fled or imprisoned or dead, any good at all? A friend of mine who works at the fire authority calls me up. "We had an interesting request here for a personal file yesterday," he says. "I thought I'd let you know." "Who was it?" "Mr. Milker," my friend chuckles. We both know without saying, Milker must think the apparatus he created was so thorough, with an administrative impetus all of its own, that somewhere, someone was keeping tabs on him. A few days later, I call Frau Paul. We chat for a while. She is active in an organization for those persecuted by the regime, taking tours of Hohenschönhausen prison. "We're thinking of putting a coffee shop in there," she tells me, "and campaigning for compensation for victims." Then she says, "There's something else." "Yes?"
"I was followed home the other evening, from a public meeting on compensation."
"What?"
"It's true. A car followed me to the underground at walking pace. I was with friends and I didn't think much about it, but when I got out of the train at Elsterwerdeerplatz, I was alone, and it was there waiting for me. Then it followed the bus. When I got off the bus, it turned its lights off and drove behind me right to my door."
"Oh, that's horrible."
"Yes," she says. "There are a lot of people who don't want us to raise our voices, to fight for what we deserve."
"Do you have any idea who it was?"
"No, but it was almost certainly an ex-Stasi man."
She is frightened, but she is steely.
"It was a Volvo," she says.
"I'm looking for a Volvo driver."
Milker died this week. He was 92. The headlines read,
"Most hated man now dead."
I think of the other most hated man and give him a call. His wife answers the phone and passes me to her husband. Karl Eduard von Schnitzler tells me he's not well and that things are getting worse. By things, he means the world around him.
"People are still spreading lies about my dear friend Erich Milker, and he's under the ground. On Monday, the urn was interred, and on Tuesday, it was desecrated. Right under the noses of the police guarding it. Do you understand? My friend's ashes were scattered, and his grave plot was desecrated."
His voice is exactly the same, hoarse, old, and angry.
"That is capitalism, naked and brutal. An absolute Unkultur."
The desecration of Milker's grave is unlikely to have been the work of Westerners, and it is only a product of capitalism in that capitalism does not protect, or not adequately to his mind, the former leadership of the former GDR from what their people thought of them. I hear fear through his voice, the flip side of fury. Fear, perhaps, that his end, soon to come, will also be a desecrated grave. Then I remember his conviction to the cause. I think he may not be so much afraid of death itself, but that it'll eliminate, finally, his powers of rebuttal. Today I walk from my place up Brunnenstrasse, past Frau Paul's tunnel, to Bernaustrasse, where the wall was. There is a new museum here. Its greatest exhibit is opposite,
a full-size reconstructed section of the wall, complete with freshly built and neatly raked death strip for tourists. Right alongside it, in Bernaustrasse, there are still some pieces of the real wall, covered, as they always were on the western side, with bright graffiti. These remnants are behind bushes, though, scrappy and crumbling. In some places the steel reinforcements in the concrete are bare as bones. The new wall, however, is pristine. It is utterly without graffiti. I can understand why the original has all but disappeared, and why, as Frau Paul and Torsten said, people wanted it to. But this new one is a sanitized Disney version. It is history airbrushed for effect. Inside the museum, there are displays and touchscreen presentations showing how the wall was built, recordings of Kennedy's Ich bin ein Berliner speech, and dramatizations of various escape attempts.
Yes, yes, yes,
a man with his back to me is saying to another man behind the counter.
I'll take them from here and bring them back here. I think it'll take about 2 hours. That's what I'm going to check now.
Right then, the other man says. Then he looks over at me. He is wearing fancy eyeglasses that appear to be held together by a row of miniature multicolored clothes pegs.
Can I help you?
The man standing at the counter turns around to have a look at me.
Frau Funder, he cries.
It is Hagen Koch.
Well, 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 how are you? Yes, you might like to come with me.
He speaks in exclamation marks. It is as if I have hardly been away. For him, the past is the wall, and I am part of the present, whether 3 years ago or now. His hair has turned white, but his eyes are the same bright and smiley brown. Herr Koch, I'm well, thank you. Come where?
I'm taking a busload of tourists tomorrow along the route where the wall was, because you can hardly tell any more. I'm off now to check how long it'll take.
I'd love to come. We're to drive along the municipal boundary where the wall was built, in a ring around the old city centre in the east, and past the western suburbs of Wedding, Morbitt, and Tiergarten. Then, he says, we will drive where the wall went right through the centre of town, down Niederkirchnerstrasse, through to the Spree River, and along its bank to the Oberbaum Bridge. We climb into his small red car, and he drives fast and sure. He is happy to have an audience to rehearse his Tour of the Forgotten City routine. The first stop is just down the street, a stretch of grass maybe 100 meters wide. Straggly weeds grow to knee height, sway like sentient things in the warm air. There's a cemetery behind here. A large stone angel on a pedestal is turned this way, her head bent low in prayer. We walk out to the middle. The sky seems wide in this place.
This was the death strip.
Herr Koch holds his arms out.
But before that, the cemetery extended to the street. When they built the wall, they had to dig up the bodies and take away the gravestones.
He raises his eyebrows.
The guards used to get a bit spooked by that.
Apparently, the border guards working on the death strip preferred no evidence of death in it. Herr Koch is pleased to be with someone who shares his interest in the wall. He is also perhaps even more obsessed with it than I remember. He seems to have lost the awareness that his is a particular interest. He is, once more, a true believer. The wall is a thing that defined him, and he will not let it go. I think for a moment of Frau Paul, who will also not let it go. Herr Koch starts to take photographs. I look up at the angel's long face, and I think of Miriam and Julia. Live shaped, too, by the wall. Will they let it go, or will it let them go? Our next stop is the Schifffahrtskanal. Herr Koch is excited, speaking fast. We park outside a new housing development. The apartments are fresh and brightly coloured. They are arranged around a courtyard in the usual Berlin style, but in a startling departure from tradition, there's an original two-story East German guard tower in the middle of the yard. Herr Koch gestures towards it.
This, he says proudly, is my tower.
For a moment he's so pleased, he's speechless. I gaze at the thing. It is unmistakably an old guard tower from the death strip.
It has square cement walls and windows up high to see in all directions. On the top there's a fenced area the guards could shoot from. It is hardly a thing of joy, but Herr Koch's face is shiny with delight. Your tower?
My tower.
He explains that at the end of 1989, in his capacity as a cultural officer with the Stasi, he took it upon himself to be responsible for Denkmalschutz, or the preservation of historical monuments. He found a lot of little white and blue National Heritage enamel plaques, and in the chaos of those last days, he went around screwing them into things precious to him, like the wall, the boom gates at Checkpoint Charlie, and guard towers. Most of them were pulled down, despite his efforts. This tower here, he says, gave him a lot of trouble, particularly when the developers came in to build the apartments.
So what did I do?
I look back at him. I cannot imagine.
I found a homeless man and installed him in it, and I gave him money and a job to renovate the tower. They couldn't pull it down because it was inhabited.
I see that over the door someone has hand-painted an address, Kielerstrasse 2. We enter, and sure enough, a modern white-tiled bathroom is being installed downstairs.
Unfortunately, Herr Koch says, my tenant died.
We climb a ladder to the top where the guards worked. The tower is crumbling and smells of wet concrete, but I enjoy the thought that the previous tenant, an old Eastern Street person, would have lapped up the view from here, where before the guards had watched over him. Herr Koch says,
but I think it is saved now. They had to build the apartments around it. The tenants didn't like it at first, but I've been talking to them, and as time goes on, they appreciate its historical significance more and more.
He takes a dustpan and brush and sweeps up proprietorially before we leave. We drive into town, past the Bundestag, the Reichstag, and Potsdamer Platz. At a set of lights, I see a bollard with a poster of Rentf promoting their current tour of the old East Germany. I enjoy the thought of Klaus strutting his stuff, blossomed once more into his rock star being. We stop in an ordinary street.
See?
Herr Koch says, opening up his arms. I look around. There's nothing to see.
You can't see. You can't see where the wall went at all.
He's right. There's no sign of it left. No bits of concrete. No wasteland.
Look down here, though.
He points to the ground. A narrow strip of granite is inlaid in the pavement, slightly darker grey than the footpath itself.
That's all there is, he cries. It used to be a red line, but even that was thought too obvious, so they came up with this instead. And what's more, in the places where it does say Berliner Mauer 1961 to 1989, it's written to be read from the western side. For us Easterners, it's upside down.
As we get back in the car, he says,
I am the only person who is keeping alive the sense of the wall from the eastern side. If there is one thing my life has taught me, it is that one must not see things just from one side. People don't like me for it, but it must be done.
Herr Koch is a lone crusader against forgetting. We drive along Zimmerstrasse, away from the centre, to Betterneindamm. It is a scrawny part of town. There are more new, brightly painted apartments on one side and grey cement buildings on the other. In between, there's what looks at first like an empty lot, fenced in with wire mesh and boards and sticks. Behind the fence, someone has planted potatoes and eggplants in neat rows and tomatoes on stakes. But I'm still not sure what we're looking at.
These, Herr Koch says, are the Turkish onions.
He takes me around the fenced area, a small triangle of land. There is an elaborate three-story shack at one end, made of pieces of fibroboard, crates, and a ladder, with a grapevine climbing over it. Outside it there's an old couch and chairs, and at the other end of the plot a child's wooden swing hangs from a tree painted red and yellow. Herr Koch says that this land was, strictly speaking, in the eastern zone, but that it was too hard to build a bend in the wall to include it, so the wall went straight along the nearest street, leaving this island of land out in the west.
No one in West Berlin knew what to do with it. It could not be resumed for any purpose without antagonizing the Eastern regime. It was, literally, no man's land. Eventually, a Turkish family simply fenced it off and planted vegetables. When the wall came down, no one seemed to have a claim, so they are gardening here still. I gaze through the fence. There's an apricot tree and a large oak at the end. I imagine great family working bees. Grandma on the couch, the kids on the swing and the smell of coffee from the summer palace at the end.
"But you know what happened?" Koch says.
I turn back to him.
"The family eventually fought. It was two brothers, I think. They fought so badly that in the end all they could do was to put a fence down the middle of the garden and split it into two separate zones."
His face is alive with the irony of it.
"Come here, look."
We walk to the middle where a 2-meter-high cyclone fence runs right through the little field, separating the part with the hut from the part with the swing, and no way of going between. Our last stop is at the Oberbaum Bridge. Berlin is a wasteland here, where the tram lines between east and west have only recently been knitted back together. The longest strip of remaining wall is along this riverbank, more because it was forgotten than deliberately preserved. At the end of it are what looked like, at first glance, a small array of circus tents. As we approach, I see there are a couple of souvenir stalls with flags flying atop and signs in English saying, "Souvenirs for you," and "I stamp your passport." For one mark, you can have your passport stamped with a GDR entry visa, as if you had stepped into this tent and miraculously been admitted to that place in the past. Elderly American tourists are climbing out of a bus. They seem to match, in pressed pale clothes and overly clean running shoes.
"Betty,"
one woman asks another in a broad southern accent,
"is that the same jacket you were wearing that day at Auschwitz?"
Herr Koch bounces into the main hall.
"Geld,"
he cries.
"Hagen, my friend!"
The stallkeeper jumps up and runs from behind his wares to greet him. Herr Koch introduces me. Gerd is a suntanned man of 60 wearing a blue shirt unbuttoned to the navel and a smile with the wattage of a vaudevillian. Herr Koch later told me he had been a theatre actor in the East. Gerd's stall is a reliquary of his country's memorabilia. He has Russian and GDR soldiers' caps, Russian medals issued as reward for service in the Berlin invasion of 1945.
Genuine, he says winningly.
Old enamel signs that read,
"You are leaving the American sector," in English, Russian, French, and German, and "Beware, mines, closed area, danger to life."
He has matchbox-sized Trabant cars, teddy bears, bottle openers, car stickers and coffee mugs. And on one side of the stall, in tiny pigeonholes, he has lots and lots of pieces of wall.
"You must take this as a gift from me," he says, and he presses a piece of the wall into my palm.
It is in a small plastic bag, complete with a certificate of authenticity. It looks like a forensic sample. The two of them are staring at me, grinning and excited. I fear at any moment they will break into song.
"How do you know this is genuine?" I ask. "Oh, it's genuine," Gerd says, twinkling like a daytime television host.
There have probably been enough genuine fragments of the wall sold to build it twice over. Herr Koch leans in, as always interested in the documents.
"Look," he says, "there's a certificate to prove it."
I thank them both and walk up to the new tram stop at Vorschauerstrasse. When I look back, I see Herr Koch has corralled the tourists and is giving them his side of history. Chapter 27. Puzzlers. I catch the train to Nuremberg. When I arrive, I drink an espresso standing up at a bar in the station. A beautiful young woman wearing a fast food wimple is serving behind the counter. The man next to me orders a Riesenbockwurst. The barmaid reaches first for potato salad and a bun, and then the boiled sausage.
"Mustard or ketchup?"
She holds the paper plate high for an answer, reaching with her free hand above the bar to where the bottles would normally be, upturned for nips. Instead, there hangs a giant yellow rubber udder. The barmaid does a neat squeeze and twist action on one of the teats, milking it for mustard. Booking my ticket, I thought of Uwe and Scheller and our puzzle women conversation so long ago. I called Uwe at the television station to catch up and to tell him I've come full circle. A former colleague answered the phone. He said Uwe took a promotion to be roving correspondent in the United States and that he and Frederica and little Lucas were now happily ensconced in Washington. I asked him to pass on my best. The Stasi File Authority office where the puzzle women are housed is in Zirndorf, a village outside Nuremberg. The office is in the same walled compound where asylum seekers are being kept. Two Ethiopians, or perhaps Eritreans, men with sad biblical faces and aimless arms, walk about the outdoor area. The director, Herr Reard, meets me at the entrance, and we go upstairs to his office. It is a plain administrative building that smells of floor wax and wet cardboard. Herr Reard is a compact man with straight white hair to his shoulders and small glasses. He's an archivist. I'm nervous as a cat. I'm in an unaccountable hurry. I've been thinking about this place for so long as the focus of Miriam's hopes. I want there to be stainless steel benches and people wearing hair nets and white cloth gloves. I want security guards on the entrances and cameras in the workrooms. I want the completed puzzle pages to be scanned into computers, correlated to the files they belong to, and for the people they affect to be called up by sensitive trained personnel and informed about the new links in their lives. I want them to find out what happened to Charlie Weber. I am sure Herr Reard has things to do, but his desk is uncluttered, and he gives me the impression of having cleared the agenda for our meeting today. He is a quiet and unassuming man who made his career in the West German archives at Koblenz, and he is now looking forward to retirement.
"Yes," he says, "I'll be 63 shortly," as if to say, "I'm out of here."
He tells me that this work started in 1995, after the sacks of material had sat around in Berlin for 5 years. 15,000 sacks were found at Normannenstrasse in January 1990. They contained shredded and hand-ripped files, index cards, photos and unwound tapes and film. Herr Reard has arranged for me to take coffee with some of the workers. I am keen to meet the puzzle people. I ask him how many there are and whether they are all women, as I have heard.
"Oh, no," he says, "but there are probably more women than men."
He is cautious and exact, and asks his secretary to check the numbers. She comes back with a note, 18 women and 13 men. First, we go down the hall to see the workrooms. On the way, he tells me there has been some controversy because the victims want the work here to go more quickly. A computer program exists that could make this happen. It puts a lot of the pieces together very fast, based on a scan of the exact shape of the ripped edge. But Herr Reard says for the purposes of evidence, the documents reconstituted by computer do not count as originals. This doesn't make much sense to me, because generally people don't bring cases, they just want to know what happened in their lives.
"And it would be very expensive," he adds.
That is more likely why it's not in use. The door opens onto an ordinary office. My eyes take in potted plants and old paint on the walls, and a poster of glassy-eyed kittens tangled in wool. There is a large desk with an empty chair behind it.
"Must be on a break," Herr Reard says, gesturing towards the chair.
But I'm only half listening. The window is wide open. A white curtain moves in the breeze, and I am panicked, my heart climbing steps up my chest, because on the desk there are masses and masses of tiny pieces of paper, some in small stacks, but others spread out all over. There are so many tatters of paper that the desk is not big enough, and the worker has started to lay them out on top of the filing cabinet as well. The pieces are different sizes, from a fifth of an A4 page to only a couple of centimetres square, and there is nothing,
nothing to stop them flying around the room and out of the window. Herr Reard misreads my face.
"Yes, it's a lot of work, as you can see," he says.
The next room is similar. This person, also on a break, seems to be sorting the material from the sacks first into cut-off cardboard boxes and then all over the desk. A woman's eye from a torn photograph looks out at me from one of the boxes. On the table I glimpse the name of the writer, Lutz Rathenau, on a shred of paper. There's a roll of double-sided sticky tape near the chair and a partially completed page in front of it. A corner and the left-hand edge. In the next room the pieces are even smaller.
"It's painstaking work," Herr Reard says. "The most pieces in one page so far has been 98.
This person has nearly completed a sheaf of pages that rest in an open manila folder. The pages are all there, piled on top of each other except for a piece or pieces missing in the middle, making a neat hole.
"It takes brute strength to tear that many pages at once,"
Herr Reard shakes his head.
"That Stasi man would have hardly been able to move his fingers the next day."
On the way to meet the workers, I ask Herr Reard about security. He tells me that everyone who works here, including the cleaning staff, is checked to make sure they have not had any involvement with the Stasi in the past, even though they are all Westerners. He says his workers are told not to speak about the content of the files they piece together. Sometimes this needs to be stressed.
"If they find, say, a file on an important West German politician, then I'll go in and have a word and remind them not to mention it at all," he says.
I ask about electronic surveillance of the rooms, because I imagine there are people out there who would pay a high price to stop some of this information coming to light.
"No, no," Herr Reard says. "Sometimes they sit two to a room, but that's more to alleviate boredom than anything else. And I make sure I put the alarm on when I leave of an evening."
This is not what I expected. It is friendly and small and low-key. It is something between a hobby farm for jigsaw enthusiasts and a sheltered workshop for obsessives. Herr Reard introduces me and leaves. There are three women and two men sitting at a table with fruit juice, biscuits and a thermos of coffee on it. They have left room for me at the head of the table. The two women on my right are both plump, made up and middle-aged. On my left there's a young woman with freckles and shoulder-length dark hair. Next to her a small, brown-haired man with glasses, and at the end a large, gentle-looking fellow with fair hair and eyes as blue as marbles. I ask them how they go about their work each day. The furthest middle-aged woman says, "It's really just like a puzzle at home. You start with the corners and fill in the rest from the shape of the edges. We get clues, too, from the sort of paper it is, the typeface or handwriting and so on."
"Do you do puzzles at home?" I ask her.
"Yes," she says. "I must be crazy."
They all laugh. The woman next to her started here only 2 months ago. She has painted nails and a gap between her two front teeth. They opened a sack to show me, and I saw the really tiny pieces inside, and I thought, "Oh, my God, I can't do that." The sacks are over a meter tall and paunchy as a person. "But every sack is different," she says. "And I have to say, there are things that are interesting." The dark man appears to be the most senior person here. He has deep-set eyes and a calm voice. The others listen closely when he speaks. He says,
"Sometimes the satisfaction is in knowing that when people find out what happened to them, it might give them some peace of mind. Why they lost their place at the university, or what happened to the uncle who disappeared or whatever. It gives those affected an insight into their own lives."
The others pour coffee and pass long-life milk down the table. I imagine getting more news about myself from a file. You would come to think of your past as a landscape you travelled through without noticing the signs.
"I think at the end the Stasi had so much information," the fair man says, "that they thought everyone was an enemy, because everyone was under observation. I don't think they knew who was for them or against, or whether everyone was just shutting up.
He is shy and looks at his hands, closed around his coffee mug when he speaks.
When I find a file where they've been watching a family in their living room for 20 years, I ask myself, what sort of people are they who want all this knowledge for themselves?
Are you moved by what you find sometimes? I ask.
The young woman answers, when I find love letters, I think, good grief, they really opened everything. And how many hands did these pass through? How many times were they copied? I'd hate for that to have happened to me. I don't feel too good about seeing them myself when I piece them together.
The dark man says he is most shocked by how the Stasi used people's own distress against them.
When they were in prison, for instance, offering to let them out on condition that they spy for the Stasi.
I think of Koch's father having to change political parties or be exiled to a Russian camp, or Frau Paul, who could have been bait in a trap to catch a Westerner, and even of Julia, imprisoned in her country and offered freedom within it only if she would inform on the people in her life. I think of the generational cycles of tragedy the Germans have been inflicting on themselves.
But this is not about the individuals, the dark man continues. It is about a system that so manipulated people that it drove them to do these things. It shows how people can be used against one another. I'm reluctant to condemn them because the Stasi were also manipulated. They too needed jobs.
The others are nodding.
On the other hand, he says, there were lots of people who just said no. Not everyone can be bought.
He tells of an engineer who refused to inform.
And nothing more happened to him. The file was simply closed.
I am reminded of the story of a factory worker who, after she was approached to inform, announced loudly the next day at the canteen table,
guess what? You wouldn't credit it, but they think me so reliable that I've been asked to inform.
Her cover blown, she was useless, and she was left alone. The young woman says,
I think there were advantages over there that we forget, particularly for mothers and children. I'm a single mum and I know what I'm talking about. I had to work and it was hard to find a kindergarten place. I have a friend who lived over there and she says she didn't want for anything.
And the rents were lower, the gap-toothed woman on my right adds.
The kindergartens were there, the dark man says, because they wanted to get the children early to bring them up loyal to the state.
Sure, the young mother says, but it all became crudely clear to me just after the wall came down. I met a couple in the street who'd just come over from the East and had no money and nowhere to go, so I said they could stay with me. They were with me for a weekend and I showed them around. We went to Karstadt department store and looked in the food section. They were beside themselves. How many kinds of ketchup do you have? They said as they looked at the shelves. Then I thought to myself, it really is too much. There must be a middle way. Do we really need 30 different kinds of ham and 15 different kinds of ketchup?
The mistake the GDR made was to force people into a position, the dark man says. Either you are for us or an enemy. And if you then came to think of yourself as an enemy, you had to ask yourself, what am I doing here? They wanted to put everything into their narrow scheme, but life simply didn't fit into it.
He pauses, and the others wait for him to finish.
But I think we need to remember that they came here for the freedom, not for 15 kinds of ketchup.
Herr Reard sees me out. I check with him what the consequences were when someone who had been approached to inform either told people about it or flatly refused.
There really were no consequences, he says. That was the thing. The file was just closed, marked dekonspiriert.
But of course, he adds,
no one could know at the time that nothing would happen to him, so hardly anyone refused.
We have reached the door. He says,
there is something I need to give you.
Without a word, he passes me a photocopied sheet of paper with some writing on it. It is a copy of a memo he wrote. Stasi File Authority, Project Group Reconstruction. Time required for reconstruction. One worker reconstructs on average per day 10 pages.
40 workers reconstruct on average per day 400 pages. 40 workers reconstruct on average in a year of 250 working days 100,000 pages. There are, on average, 2,500 pages in one sack. 100,000 pages amounts to 40 sacks per year. In all, at the Stasi File Authority, there are 15,000 sacks. This means that to reconstruct everything, it would take 40 workers 375 years. I am speechless. I can only understand this as a small paper protest. Herr Reard points at the page. These are the figures for 40 workers, he says. As you see, we only have 31. He is telling me in his quiet way that the resources United Germany is throwing at this part of reconstructing the lives of its former East German citizens are pitiful. Some kind of Sisyphean joke. What he is running here is an almost totally symbolic act. Herr Reard has organized a driver to take me from Zirndorf back to Nuremberg. The day is a clear, sunny blue. Away from the asylum seekers and scraps of paper, everything is bright and cheerful. I look out the window, thinking about Miriam and her hopes that the torn-apart pieces of her life will be put back together in those airy rooms, sometime in the next 375 years. Chapter 28. Miriam and Charlie. The train back to Berlin passes through Leipzig, and I get off. It's morning. The air is still with a silken warmth that will work itself into something real by midday. Last time, the station was being renovated. It is now part of a three-story shopping mall in a vast atrium. Escalators move people up and down between levels. Near the exit, there's a display of photographs of the demonstrations 10 years ago. The sign over them reads, Leipzig, City of Heroes. I'm not sure what I'm doing here. I wander through town. Most of the cranes are gone. New facades of buildings in sun yellow and dusty pink, some even gilded, have been revealed from behind scaffolding. I walk past the town hall and past Auerbach's cellar. Next door, a new museum has been inserted into the old streetscape, the Contemporary History Forum, Leipzig. The inside is all terrazzo flooring and expensive fittings. This, it turns out, is the federally funded effort to put the history of the separation of Germany behind glass. There are the famous pictures of the wall being built, an Eastern soldier deciding to make a run for it to the west, parting the barbed wire with his hands, and Peter Fechter, the 18-year-old shot trying to escape in 1962 and left to die on the death strip because each side thought the other would retaliate if they went to help him. Someone has thrown him a roll of bandages, but he lies immobile and bleeding. There are pictures of people coming out of a tunnel in West Berlin, the successful group before Frau Paul tried. And there's a grey paddy wagon parked inside here, exactly the same as the one in which she was transported to her trial. A TV monitor shows Karl Edward von Schnitzler in his acidic prime. I come to the 70s and find a glass case with a display of Renft memorabilia. Records, Klaus's old guitar, and pictures of the band, its hairy, bell-bottomed members looking both innocent and louche. I'm the only visitor. The attendants are eager to make eye contact and chat, bored as bats. Perhaps because of all the money poured into this, the things behind the spanking displays look old and crummy, like articles from a time that has been left behind. I slap down the stairs in my sandals. I am annoyed that this past can look so tawdry and so safe, as if destined from the outset to end up behind glass, securely roped off and under press-button control. And I'm annoyed at myself. What's the problem? Isn't a museum the place for things that are over? It's a fair walk from here, but I think I remember the way, so I set off for the Runde Ecke. I hope it's still there, that this slick Western-funded version is not all that remains of East Germany. I know that on the outskirts of town there are the usual socialist high-rises, but here the streets are cobbled and the buildings are grand. Carved faces stare down from the archways over arcades, and a row of caryatid creatures holds up the old theatre. I pass a music shop. This was the home of Bach. A bistro and a funeral parlour with a surprising range of offerings available. The sign says, day and night. Burial, cremation, burial at sea, and anonymous burials are listed, as well as transport of coffins. A dog walks purposefully along the pavement, and somewhere, I think, a person is lost. Its high-headed confidence makes me smile. A man in a tobacconist's window sees me and smiles back. The building is still there, its vastness covering the block and ending in the round corner where the entry is. When I reach it, I see that the Citizens' Committee's museum still exists, and it's open. Inside me, a small, stretched thing dissolves with relief. I go up the stone stairs. The entry to the exhibition is on the left, and to the Leipzig branch of the Stasi File Authority on the right. Nothing much has changed. I walk down the corridor, past the workroom with the girly calendar, and the cell with its tiny window and bed, to the museum office. There are signs requesting donations for funds to keep the place running. Frau Hollitzer's not here today, but yes, her young colleague tells me, she still works with the Bürger Committee. I ask him about the new museum in town, and he shrugs and says something about the incompatibility of funding and autonomy. They had tried to negotiate with the federal authorities about having just one museum of divided Germany in Leipzig and one run by Easterners, but it hadn't worked. This museum has been left a smaller, shabbier outfit than the other, but for all that, it's more authentic. Here, in this building, where people were held and interrogated, where upstairs their stolen biographies were filed away. I spent some time in the rooms, seeing the piles of file pulp in one, the moustaches and wigs and glue in another, and the smell sample jars in a third. For me, this is where it all began. I buy a couple of books from the young man and leave. Outside it is hot. Since morning the trees have deepened their green and are making darker shadows. I have nothing more to do here but wander back to the station. I walk through a small park where people are eating lunch on benches. The air is quiet, apart from birdsong, and the soughing of trams and a rolling sound behind me getting louder. I turn and two boys on skateboards are coming towards me, fast. Before I can decide which edge of the path to keep to, they separate around me in graceful formation, one on each side, then join up again. I watch them glide out of the park. They perform the same manoeuvre on a girl in a phone booth. She keeps talking as she leans out of the box to see them skate on. When I am near the phone, I find myself looking at the girl. She's wearing a white midriff top and jeans and chewing gum as she chats. I can't hear what she's saying, but she's completely absorbed in it, leaning one heel on her knee into the booth. She's probably 16, which means she was 6 years old when the wall fell. She wouldn't remember a time without telephone boxes. Before I know why I am stopped here, she sees me and nods to let me know she won't be much longer. I'm relieved for a moment to have found a purpose, but I'm stuck now. When she hangs up, she waves and walks to her bicycle. I move to the booth. 16, I think. 16 was when she got on a train from here for Berlin and climbed the wall. That's all I think. But I open my address book at her number and dial.
Hello?
Miriam? Miriam, it's Anna Funder here. I'm...
Anna! Where are you calling from? Are you back in Berlin?
I'm actually in Leipzig, I say. I thought of you and thought I'd just call to say hi while I'm here. I didn't know if you still had the same number. I've been in Nuremberg and I'm on my way back to Berlin.
I'll come and get you, she says. Where are you?
Near the station, I think.
Okay. I'll be at the side entrance in 10 minutes.
I see her come towards me. She is dressed entirely in white, loose pants and a flowing top. She is my height, though finely built. When she hugs me, I feel the wing bones of her shoulder blades beneath my hands.
She lifts her sunglasses and her eyes are the same blue, but the lines in her face are much more deeply drawn.
"I've moved house since you were last here," she explains.
We drive over cobbled streets from the station, under elms and plane trees and tram wires. Miriam's is a corner building, beautifully restored. Hand-painted flowers curl up the walls of the grand stairway, and at the back, a discreet steel and glass lift takes us up. Once more, her apartment is on the top level. The living room straddles the corner and all the windows are open. I move to the sill. Across the street there's another fine building with a glass atrium on its roof, and behind it, a field of grass and trees stretching as far as I can see.
"That's the Leipzig Heath," she says behind me. "It's lovely for a walk. We can go there later if you like. The Leipzig Zoo is there too, which is worth a look."
"What's that smell?" I ask.
"It could be the big cat enclosure," she chuckles.
"No, it's sweet."
"Oh, that's the acacias."
She joins me at the window and points to the top of the glorious trees right below us. Cream flowers dangle in bunches like grapes.
"It's a beautiful perfume, isn't it?" she says. "More beautiful, at any rate, than the lions."
She laughs and touches my arm. Miriam makes tea and we sit to talk. She doesn't seem surprised by my arrival, or not as surprised as I am to find myself with her. It is as if she always expected us to see one another again, almost like friends. What are a few missed phone calls between friends? The scented air moves gently around us. The apartment has a parquetry floor, pale walls, and a new kitchen at one end of this room. The adjoining room is a large space covered with a deep chalk-coloured carpet. It is lined with books and plants, and there's a computer in the corner, the screensaver on clouds. Everything is white and light and comfortable. I tell Miriam about my travels, about Stasi men and Julia's schoolgirl ordeal, about kidnappings and babies left on the wrong side of the wall, about Remft and Professor Mushroom. I tell her I've just come from Nuremberg, where I spoke with the puzzle women, who turned out to be men as well. A few dozen people doing something that will take a very long time. I find I can't say 375 years.
"Everything in this place," she says, "takes a very long time."
We are sitting at a glass-topped cane table. Miriam slips her sandals off and rests her feet on its supports. Her hair is still cropped short, but it is now dyed a deep chestnut brown. She wears the same small, round eyeglasses and smiles the same kind and sudden smile, the shadows between her teeth overdefined by nicotine.
"A very long time," she says again, lighting a cigarette.
A breeze comes through, pushing her clothes against skin, revealing again for an instant how slight she is underneath, something I forgot because of her magnificent voice. Miriam works at a public radio station. Recently, she was asked to make a program on nostalgia parties, where if you show an East German ID, you get in for free. Everyone calls one another comrade, and the beer is only 1 Deutschmark 30 Pfennigs. She says,
"Things like this feed into a crazy nostalgia for the GDR, as if it had been a harmless welfare state that looked after people's needs. Most of the people at these parties are too young to remember the GDR anyway. They are just looking for something to yearn for."
Some of the men running the radio station are former Stasi informers, or, in one case, a former Stasi employee. This shocks me, but Miriam shrugs.
"The old cadre are back in power," she says.
She knows that one of them used to pass on listeners' letters of complaint and comments to the Stasi, and he knows she knows.
"He can't look at me," she says.
When she declined to make the nostalgia program, he said to her,
"You know what your problem is? Your problem is you don't identify with the culture of the station."
Miriam rolls her eyes at the ridiculousness of the former Stasi man recycling Stasi threats, substituting station for nation. The program was made by someone else and broadcast anyway, feeding into the creeping nostalgia that here takes the place of a sense of belonging.
The putt-putt of Vespa motorbikes reaches us from below. The sound makes me think of beachy places, although we are landlocked deep in Central Europe. I ask her what Charlie was like.
"Well," she says, "I haven't sorted all my pictures yet. They are still in that old suitcase."
She gets up and goes into her bedroom. I understand perfectly the impulse not to file him away under plastic in an album or in a frame. And suddenly, it is clear to me why the new museum was so irritating. Things have been put behind glass, but they are not yet over.
Miriam shows me a couple of old black-and-white photographs and a Kodachrome colour snap like those from my childhood. I get a shock.
"This is you?" I ask. The photograph is of a young couple seated at a table. I recognize him from the last time. Clear-faced, square-jawed Charlie. He's wearing a top hat but no shirt, larking around. I would not have recognized Miriam. The girl is exquisite, extraordinarily beautiful. She is thin and smooth-skinned, with a chiseled face and a breathtaking smile. She is utterly natural, but she could have come out of any magazine, then or now.
"That was after our wedding," Miriam says. "We went and had lunch."
I remember the torn photo. I'm glad she has let herself remain in existence in this one. There's another picture of the two of them, she with her arms around him, looking at the camera. She is an apparition, a naughty angel caught flying over the wall, put in a cage and then let out, here with her beloved. In the third, a younger Miriam stares solemnly at the camera from under a fringe. She looks about 12.
"That one was just when I got out of prison," she says. "My grandmother made me that dress."
"But you look so young," I say.
"I was, I guess," she says. "I was 17 and a half.
I look at her. She has no vanity. She has expected no reaction to the beauty in the pictures. The sun slants in, painting half her face golden. I would never have seen this girl in her.
"There's this, too," she says. "I thought of it last time you were here, and I found it afterwards."
She passes me a piece of paper folded into quarters.
"I don't think I'd looked through that stuff since Charlie died, actually."
She breathes in.
"It was hard for me to dig up."
The page is yellow with age and slightly torn. On one side, there are rows of handwriting in pencil crossed out and started again. On the back, a clean version.
"It's a poem of Charlie's," she says.
"Can I make a copy?"
"Please, just take it," she says. "Send it back to me sometime."
"What was he like?" I ask again. She flicks a lighter for flame and leans back in her chair.
"Well, he was a sensitive person," she says. "He was quite reserved. He noticed things. He had a good sense of humour, but underneath, I'd say, he took things to heart."
She looks out the window, at the sky moving past.
"He was individualistic and an only child. That's why it is so hard for my parents-in-law."
Miriam gets up and collects a bowl of cherries from the kitchen.
"Our friends thought our marriage was a catastrophe," she laughs, sitting down again. "But for us it was ideal."
"Why did they think that?"
"Each of us did our own thing, to a certain extent, of course. It might be that one of us would want to go to the cinema and the other wouldn't, so one would just go alone. We thought that was quite normal. Or I remember coming back from being away in Gera and running into Charlie in the corridor. I said, 'Are you coming or going?' He said, 'I'm going out for a bit. See you tomorrow, then.'"
Voices float up from the street, single notes of human music.
"Our friend said, 'But that's no sort of marriage. For us, though, it was the only way we could be. That's why it worked so well.'"
She spits a cherry pip into her hand.
"I think it came, at least on my side, from my experience in prison. I reacted extremely when I got out of there. I just couldn't plan ahead. I couldn't say to someone, 'I'll meet you on Sunday.' I found that sort of thing an unbearable obligation. She laughs. I'm sure I was hard to get on with.
I can't imagine her being hard to get on with, but I know she is hard to pin down. And I know, all of a sudden, that she really is pleased to see me, that this is the continuation of a conversation begun 3 years ago. She got my messages and my letter, and from an impulse I now understand, did not tie herself down with a response. Having had her every move anticipated by them for so long, these days she just wants to let things unroll, and my turning up here is part of the unrolling.
After we wrote our applications to leave, things got pretty awful, she says. They began to harass us on the street. We were constantly stopped. We were followed in the car quite a lot, too. They really wanted to make life unpleasant for us. Eventually, Charlie was called in to the Department of the Interior for questioning. He said he just wanted an answer to his application, yes or no. That was the first time they locked him up. After he was released, the card started appearing in the letterbox, calling him in to room 111 at Dimitrovstrasse. Dimitrovstrasse was the police building, but Charlie Weber came to know that room 111 meant an appointment with the Stasi. The complex had an internal yard, and you could walk in thinking you were going to clear up an administrative quirk and suddenly find yourself in a room being interrogated by the Stasi, or even locked up on remand in a cell out back. Miriam pauses. The last time Charlie went in there, he went to his appointment in room 111 and ended up in one of those.
"You wanted to exhume the coffin," I ask. "What happened?"
She unwraps a new packet of cigarettes from its plastic. Her fingers are hard-looking and blue from lack of oxygen. "The district attorney's office here just want to cover up everything that happened then. And most of all, they don't want to pursue any of the Stasi. There are a lot of reasons for this, I imagine, but in part it must be because they are still working with people who were with the Stasi. They are their colleagues. The judge, for instance, who signed the warrant for Charlie's arrest that last time he went into remand, is still on the bench."
"But there has been a development. The DA has found a witness to what happened in the cells the day Charlie died. Another prisoner."
"According to that person's account," Miriam says, "there was a commotion in Charlie's cell early in the morning. Something happened, and the guard called others who came running. Then they all left. The witness says everything was quiet until midday, when they came to bring the meal. Then the guard had to call more guards again, and voices were raised in the cell. You'd think this new evidence would give some impetus to the inquiries, but no. The DA later informed me that he'd found another former prisoner who credibly assured him that he heard nothing from the other cells that day. Once more, he wanted to use that as a reason to close the matter."
Miriam has lost faith in this investigation. About a month ago, she sent the file and all the correspondence over the years directly to the Minister for Justice.
"I haven't got an answer from him yet," she says, "but I'm waiting."
She has an elbow on the armrest and her chin in her palm.
"And of course there are still the puzzlers," she says. "I know for a fact that there were lots of pieces of paper that they didn't even put in the sacks, so they haven't been gathered up and sent to Nuremberg yet. Maybe there's something about Charlie in them."
I don't say anything for a moment. Then I ask her what she thinks happened that day in the cell.
"Charlie was stubborn. I know from when he was in custody before that he would refuse to cooperate, to speak or to go out into the exercise pen. I think maybe he wouldn't answer them or something when they came to his cell in the morning and they roughed him up and he hit his head against the wall. Then they probably left him in the cell, and when they came back at lunchtime, they found him where he'd fallen. He was most likely dead or dying, and that's why they called in the other guards then, too."
She stubs out a cigarette and keeps stubbing the butt. She is probably right about what happened, but will digging him up reveal anything?
Perhaps it might prove whether he died by hanging or not, but at whose hands? Or, if they cremated him, as the file indicates, there will be nothing in the coffin that can tell her what happened, and she will still be here, with only the frail comfort of theories. For now, though, this terrible game of waiting keeps her suspended from her life with Charlie, still in contact. And underneath the need to know is the need for justice. The regime may be gone, but the world cannot be set to rights until Miriam has some kind of justice. Things have been put behind glass, but it is not yet over. We talk into the evening, and eat tomato and basil, prosciutto and melon. Miriam speaks of friends, but she has no partner in life.
"Too hard," she says sadly, "to explain everything."
I ask her about her family. Her mother, she says, is a social climber.
"You'd think that would have been hard under socialism, but she managed to give it a go," she laughs.
Her sister is a dentist.
"You would have seen her office downstairs in this building."
I'm glad her sister is close. "And your father?"
"My father was a doctor," she says. "A very kind man. He died in the early 70s, relatively young."
She taps the cigarette packet on the table.
"Of lung cancer."
"Oh.
But the thing about that is," she says as she exhales, "it doesn't take very long at all."
Through the double doors into the next room, my eyes catch a doll's china stare. It is an old puppet in a white silky suit, hanging limbs akimbo from its crucifix of strings on the corner of a bookshelf. Miriam asks me to stay, and insists on giving me her bed. I wake in the night and need water and air. On the way from the bathroom to the window over the heath, I see her in the moonlight and stop. She is asleep on the floor of the living room, in loose white pajamas, with a blindfold across her eyes. Her neck is bent and her arms and legs are spread-eagled over a round, flat cushion. She's so slender and crumpled, her whole body nearly fits onto it, strings cut, in the spotlight. In the morning, Miriam takes me to the station. To my relief, I find a coffee shop so I can give Charlie's poem back to her. She comes to the platform and waits till the train moves out, silent and slow. The girl opposite me lip-smacks her puppy. On the platform, an older dog huffs and rearranges itself in jealousy. Then Miriam waves and walks away, straight-backed into the sunlight. I like trains. I like their rhythm, and I like the freedom of being suspended between two places, all anxieties of purpose taken care of. For this moment, I know where I am going. We are quickly outside Leipzig, moving past maize and wheat and medieval-looking water towers near each station.
Lutherstadt Wittenberg, Bitterfeld, Wannsee.
In one field there's a scarecrow equipped for all comers in a black motorcycle helmet. Behind him, a parachutist looks for touchdown. Two boys in a dinghy sit among the reeds in this vast, flat sea of improbable green, fishing. I move back from the window, and the puppy finds me suddenly fascinating. It has caught the rustle of paper in my pocket. I take out Charlie's poem. In this land, I have made myself sick with silence. In this land, I have wandered, lost. In this land, I hunkered down to see what will become of me. In this land, I held myself tight, so as not to scream. But I did scream so loud that this land howled back at me, as hideously as it builds its houses. In this land, I have been sown. Only my head sticks, defiant, out of the earth. But one day it too will be mown, making me, finally, of this land. I fold it and think of Charlie Weber, now of this land. And I think of Miriam, a maiden blowing smoke in her tower. Sometimes she can hear and smell them, but for now the beasts are all in their cages.
I walk home to the apartment from Rosenthaler Platz station. The park is alive, the light so bright it picks out people and their shadows in exaggerated 3D. Sunbathers loll on the grass, some in trunks and some bare-bottomed. There are teenagers removing gum from their mouths to kiss, a sheepdog with a single forelock dyed green, an adolescent cripple in a baby pusher being taken for a stroll. People shake infants up and down to make them calm, and children spin on swings and roundabouts I never noticed were there. That was Stasiland by Anna Funder, read by Danica Fairman.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this program. Audible hopes you've enjoyed this program.